Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine. We're going to begin the Fall 2021 issue, Resilience, Tar Heels, Tragedies, and Triumphs. The photograph on the cover has a caption on the inside, and it says, "We don't know much about the photograph on the cover, other than it was taken during a flood in Beaufort, Carteret County, in 1933. But the people look pretty cheery, given that the street is flooded. Use your skills as a historian to examine the photo. What is going on here? What is the mood of the people? And what is their relationship? Has the storm passed? What can you tell about the street or the stores? Also notice that the water is not very deep. Why are the men and boys standing in the water and the woman is not? Do their clothes offer any clues?" Next is the letter for this issue from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Association Program Coordinator, Jessica Pratt. "Hey, y'all. A few years ago when the Tar Heel Junior Historian Association team brainstormed future magazine topics, we decided to commemorate some tough times from history that would have anniversaries this year. But we didn't want a sad or scary magazine. And after thinking about it, we decided to use this issue to examine the ways North Carolinians have pulled together and worked through hard times. We listed the theme on the calendar for 2021, and then bam, in the spring of 2020, while in the middle of planning annual convention and judging contests, we found ourselves in a worldwide health pandemic. We completed 2020 contest judging virtually and announced the winners. But a favorite Tar Heel Junior Historian Association tradition, the annual convention, was canceled. The museum closed, employees started working from home, and THJHA clubs couldn't gather to put the finishing touches on their group art entries. As we worked on this issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian, we recognized that not only were we going to be sharing examples of resilience from past times, but we all were making resilience history as we continued to work, learn, and stay at home. I came to understand that resiliency means more than being heroic and brave. Sometimes merely moving forward shows resiliency, finding the good even when things aren't as you expected them to be. As the 2020-2021 school year started, we saw clubs adapting to the pandemic. I joined the members of the Roots of FLS Club for their virtual tour of a local historic site. We held Zoom meetings for club advisors. Students submitted their 2021 contest entries online, and we debuted a digital version of the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine. Also, we were happy to hold the THJHA annual convention virtually for 2021, reaching clubs that could not attend the in-person event in the past. We look forward to the 2021-2022 school year and to continuing with Tar Heel Junior Historian Association, returning to some of its favorite traditions while incorporating some of the new ways of doing things that our resilience led us to try during the past months. And there's a photograph with the caption, "The 2021 annual convention sure looked different from any other, on your end and ours. Here, Chelsea Wieger works the controls while I prepare to make the day's opening remarks." First article, the introduction to the issue, is simply titled Resilience. It's written by Jessica A. Bandel. Jessica is editor of the North Carolina Governor's Papers Project and is the conceptual editor for this issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine. "Whenever I've faced tough times in my life, I have often looked to the example my dad set for me in overcoming adversity. By the age of 10, he had lost both of his parents. His mother Maureen, an Irish immigrant who had moved to the United States with her sister Noreen on the heels of World War II, died of cancer when he was just 7 years old. I don't know too much more about her than that. Dad did not speak about her much. He was even more tight-lipped about his birth father, whose name he literally never spoke to my sisters or me. Following Maureen's death, my biological grandfather abandoned my dad, legally severing all ties to him at the insistence of a new wife. I never could imagine how hard it must have been for my dad. I still can't. Fortunately, Dad's Aunt Noreen and her husband Norman, a veteran fighter pilot whom she had met during the war, intervened and adopted him. But a lot of damage had already been done. My dad, you see, was a terrible child after he lost his parents. Family lore abounds with tales of my dad's bad behavior, burying Noreen's jewelry in the backyard, dismantling anything with an engine, dropping out of school his senior year because he was bored, riding a motorcycle through a mall. Then at 17, he stole something from an employer and landed in front of a weary judge. My dad had two options, the judge explained, jail time or military service. Dad wisely chose the latter. As it turns out, that was just what he needed to turn his life around. In the Army, he flourished. Like my grandpa Norman, he became first an aircraft mechanic and later a pilot. He gained a reputation for moral courage, integrity, professional excellence, and self-sacrificing leadership, qualities that his superiors took notice of. Special operations training followed, and by 1991, we were living down near the equator in Panama. For those 3 years, we lived in what can only be described as a tropical paradise. Monkeys, toucans, iguanas, bananas, coconuts, and mangoes all could be found right in our yard. But our time there could also be tough. Dad was away a lot, on secret and dangerous missions to other Latin American countries, sometimes missing holidays or birthdays. On the whole, though, our family's future looked and felt so promising. We moved to Tennessee in 1994, and my dad joined the elite 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment. Superiors again raved about his work ethic and abilities and put him up for promotions. We were a family of six by then, and I was just a normal kid focused on learning spelling words and begging my parents for a puppy. Our lives were about to take an unexpected turn, however. 2 weeks before my 13th birthday, my dad died of cancer. It had been a 3-year battle, and he was just so exhausted and sick. I responded to his death with anger, and I stayed angry until college, when a key realization totally changed my approach to life. My dad had had all the exact same feelings, too, about the tragedies in his life, and yet he overcame them. This ability to overcome obstacles and adversity is called resilience. It is perhaps the most meaningful lesson my dad taught me, one that I return to in times of sorrow or hardship. Resiliency can take many forms. It can be a small act. When you fall off your bike, you get back on. It can seem ordinary and insignificant. During the COVID-19 pandemic, you kept reading and learning so you didn't fall behind in your studies. Or it can be something that captures the attention of the entire world, like when 15-year-old Dorothy Counts faced down a mob of angry white citizens to help integrate the Charlotte public schools in 1957. In this issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, we bring you a collection of stories just like that, of North Carolinians who have demonstrated resiliency during times of great crisis or hardship, from the colonial era up through September 11, 2001. The Tar Heel citizens have faced it all. Floods, pandemics, wars, inequality. And each time they proved resilient. They survived. They lifted each other up. They led the way. They fought for equality. They rebuilt. They built anew. They left this place a little better for me and for you. With resiliency, what can't you do? Think about it. We were still planning this issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine in 2020, right when the COVID-19 pandemic hit. No one knew in the beginning what was going to happen, what it would be like, or how long it would last. As we moved from 2020 into 2021, we had to learn to roll with the punches. We had to figure out how to do a lot of things in a new way. We know that you've been doing that too. It was not always easy, was it? During this time, we kept hearing people use the word resilience. We wondered, how did North Carolinians face hard times throughout history? How did they find resilience? As you read the stories in this magazine, keep these questions in mind. What were the challenges the people faced? How did they show courage or resilience? And what can we learn from their stories? Here are the captions for the photos that accompany the article, Resilience. My father, Robert F. Bandel, on his third birthday in 1963 with his birth parents, Maureen and Robert Dennis. Robert F. Bandel in 1979, shortly after his enlistment. And my grandpa, Norman Bandel, was very proud of the young man my father had become. He attended my dad's flight school graduation ceremonies and posed for this picture with my mom, Nancy, and my dad. There's also a sidebar article, Are You a Brat? We know what you're thinking, but we aren't talking about being spoiled. Military brat is a slang term used for children whose parents or guardians are in the United States Armed Forces. Oftentimes, soldiers are ordered to move to bases or posts where their skills are most needed. That can mean that soldiers and their families move from state to state or even to new countries every few years. Military members, spouses, and kids learn quickly to be flexible and adapt to new places and new adventures. Moving schools and making new friends can be challenging, but it's another way to show resilience. There's an accompanying photograph, and its caption says, No one quite knows where the term military brat came from, but it's an expression of affection. And most kids wear it as a badge of honor, like these teens who marched in the annual Veterans Day parade in Fayetteville in 2018. The next article is Diamond City, Living on the Edge for Generations, written by Karen Willis Amspacher, who is executive director of the Cora Sound Waterfowl Museum and Heritage Center on Harkers Island. My family came from Diamond City, a place that's gone from maps now. In the 1800s, it was made of little hamlets built on the highest part of Shackelford Banks, on the southern arm of the Outer Banks of North Carolina. Storms have always shaped our landscape, and us, forcing us to live with the constant knowledge that our future, like our past, will be determined by the weather, the winds, and the tide, and the changes they bring to our way of life. Before 1900, Diamond City was a series of communities along Shackelford Banks, Mullet Pond, Sam Windsor's Lump, and Wade's Shore, to name just a few. More than 500 people made their living whaling, fishing, and working for the life-saving service and as lighthouse keepers. They had their own school, stores, and congregation of Methodists. Their connection to the rest of the world was across the Sound to Harkers Island and through Beaufort via sail skiff. My family's story is the same story as most all the people I grew up with on Harkers Island. They were whalers and fishermen, subsistence living on the most narrow of barrier islands south of mainland Carteret County. For generations, weathered shacks housed families that depended on the natural resources around them to feed their families. A few fruit trees and small gardens supplemented what was mostly a diet of seafood caught along the shore by hand or with homemade nets and wooden boats. In the last decade of the 1800s, storms caused the sand to sweep across the land over and over. Salt water got into wells. Trees died. It became no place to live, and the people living there had to face the reality of living on a sandbar. People grew weary and began to talk of moving to higher ground, away from the only home they had ever known. On August 17, 1899, the San Ciriaco hurricane, the strongest of all storms, crossed the coast of North Carolina, leaving behind an unrecoverable path of destruction. And then the migration began in earnest for Diamond City's families as they began to move inland. They literally took down their homes in sections and loaded them across skiffs, loaded with all their belongings, in search of a new place to carry on their way of life. Some went to Salter Path on Bogue Banks. Some went to the shoreside area of Morehead City, known as Promised Land. But most of them only went as far as they had to, back sound to Harker's Island. Divine Guthrie, my great-great-grandfather, was a fisherman and boat builder. His son and my great-uncle was Stacy Guthrie, who was a boy moved to Harker's Island. There he continued the life he knew on Shackleford, building boats, helping with the whaling crews of the shore-based whaling industry on Shackleford, and fishing to feed my family. My grandmother, Addie Guthrie, was 8 years old when she came to Harker's Island. She and Uncle Stacy both told me of the banks, the whaling crews, and the storms that changed their lives. She grew tough quickly, married young. After her husband died from rheumatic fever, the same winter her 6-year-old son died of the same disease, she ironed for the Coast Guard for pennies a day to feed her family. They would have starved if it had not been for the sound and the fishermen in the neighborhood who fed them. I grew up on the Harker's Island that held tight to that land on Shackleford, that place called Diamond City, even though the families had been forced to move to higher ground. Every summer and a lot of winter weekends, the people of Harker's Island would go to their camps on Shackleford to spend days and weeks holding on to those connections to that land. Without being told, I knew I was part of that. I always knew that the waters between Harker's Island and Shackleford Banks did not divide us, but rather connected us to where our crowd came from. My parents' generation made sure we did not forget. Today, the Corusound Waterfowl Museum and Heritage Center and other organizations dedicated to this history gather every 5 years to go home to a place that we have never lived, but our families did before we did. We go back to Diamond City, both young and old, to honor our place and the people who once lived there. We go by boat and we wade ashore just like they did. We laugh and cry, read scripture and sing and pray, and hold on to this place, now in the hands of the Park Service, but still ours in a deeper way than a written deed could ever convey. Diamond City Homecoming, celebrated every 5 years, brings together families who share these common ties, remembering loved ones they never knew, coming home to a place they've never lived. Our last Diamond City Homecoming took place in 2019, the 120th anniversary of the great storm that drove these communities inland. We had just come through Hurricane Florence the year before, so we were once again very conscious of the power of storms, not just for past generations, but for our own lives. The great writer Wallace Stegner might well have been thinking about our kind of people when he wrote, "Tell me where you're from, and I'll tell you who you are." There is nowhere on the planet where this truth is more evident than along the shores of North Carolina's Outer Banks. We have been born and raised in the reality of a changing world, of the determination of our ancestors and our responsibility to be strong, determined, and courageous in the way we raise our children. For us, we are part of them, and they are part of us. Through the stories of their struggles, the challenges they overcame, and the firm foundation of family they left behind. Now, generations later, descendants of those Diamond City families hold on to their ancestral ties to these windswept shores with a sacred allegiance to their home place, returning often, renewing their ties to this place and to one another. Here are the captions to the accompanying photographs. NASA astronaut and North Carolina native Christina Koch took this photograph of the more recent Hurricane Dorian from the International Space Station during a flyover on Monday, September 2, 2019. The author's great-great-grandfather, Divine Guthrie, boat builder, whaler, fisherman, who lived and worked around Diamond City on Shackelford Banks in the late 1800s. Recent drone photo of the Cape Lookout Light Station in Shackelford Banks. And Cape Lookout Light Station, May 17, 1893, before the storms. And continuing with the theme of hurricanes, here is the winner of the secondary division of the North Carolina, of the Tar Heel Junior Historian Association magazine article contest, Matthew Peluso. He's a member of Peluso Junior Historians, Peluso Christian Academy, New Bern, Don Peluso Advisor. He's the winner of the 2021 Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine article contest, secondary division for Disaster Comeback, Hurricane Florence. Over the course of history, there have been many natural and economic disasters that struck North Carolina. Over the years, North Carolinians have come back to be as strong or stronger than they were to begin with. One of the best examples is hurricanes. Throughout North Carolina history, there have been many hurricanes that have hit the coast. One of the most recent was Hurricane Florence, which caused mass destruction in the eastern part of North Carolina. On September 14, 2018, Hurricane Florence made landfall at Wrightsville Beach in southern North Carolina as a slow-moving Category 1 hurricane. For the next 2 days, it dumped more than 30 inches of rain and 10 feet of storm surge, which combined with the rain flooded more than 50,000 homes and left millions without power. Even after the initial strike, several towns and counties would stay flooded for another week. After the initial strike and rain subsided, many local organizations that did not flood opened as shelters or relief supply distribution points. Some of the ones in eastern North Carolina included RCS, Religious Community Services, Two Rivers Church, AmeriCorps, Baptist Men's Ministry, Samaritan's Purse, the Red Cross, and All Hands and Hearts, plus others throughout the state. For the next 6 to 8 weeks, all these places were loaded with supplies and distributed them to victims in the surrounding areas. After the first 8 weeks or so, there were still distribution points, but there was less demand. While these places were distributing supplies, teams of local volunteers, as well as volunteers from surrounding states as far as New York and Colorado, came to help clean out all the flood damage in all those houses. Following the initial relief efforts in the first 2 months, North Carolina saw a more organized relief effort to work toward rebuilding the houses that had previously been cleaned out. Some of the groups that were helping in the more eastern part of the state included Sharing Hope Ministries from Pennsylvania, working mostly in New Bern, Samaritan's Purse out of Boone, which had three main locations in New Bern, Wilmington, and Jacksonville, IDES, the International Disaster Emergency Services, AmeriCorps, and the Baptist Men's Ministry. With the help of eastern North Carolina locals, these organizations went to work repairing and finishing houses all over eastern North Carolina. The average cost of a home refinish was $15,000 to $20,000. With the severity and unusually large amount of flooding from the storm, hundreds of houses that weren't in the floodplain were inundated with several feet of water. While Hurricane Florence caused much flash flooding and storm surge, there are groups of researchers at North Carolina Coastal Federation who say that all of the wetlands that were restored over the last few years helped to lessen the effects. While we can't prevent all natural disasters, we can work to take preventative measures, such as helping to build up our wetlands so that when the next one hits, it will help to lessen the effects. Through the years, our state has faced many disasters, both natural and those caused by humans, But through it all, North Carolinians have shown great resilience. While some things are hard to deal with, North Carolina and its residents have come back from many natural disasters, such as Hazel, Floyd, and Florence. Pandemics such as the Spanish flu in 1918, or the economic crashes of the 1930s and 2007-2008. There's a photograph with this essay, and the caption is, "Members of the American Red Cross, along with other groups, worked with community members to bring relief supplies to North Carolinians impacted by Hurricane Florence." Next up, stories from our collection. Did you know that objects tell stories? Your North Carolina Museum of History collects these artifacts, the things that people create, use, and leave behind to bring the state's history to life. Here are a few of those stories. A pair of stickball sticks, circa 1916. Do you play lacrosse, or have you watched a team play? Did you know it is very similar to a game called stickball that American Indians have played for generations? Often, early stickball games were major events that could last for days, with players from different tribes competing. These stickball sticks are made from split oak and are inscribed with the name Robert Crow. The photo is one of 9 Cherokee players in the Quala boundary. Written on the back is the caption, "Wolftown Cherokee Ball Team, 1888. Photo by James Mooney, BAE 1392. Nurses' Veil and Mask, circa 1917-1918. In 2020-2021, we saw many frontline healthcare workers in the news fighting COVID-19. Most were wearing PPE, personal protective equipment, such as masks, face shields, gowns, and gloves. At the end of World War I, the world faced a similar pandemic with the 1918 Spanish flu. This veil and gauze mask were part of an American Red Cross uniform worn by Pauline J. Williams, later Kuntz, while nursing flu victims in a Wilmington hospital. A note in the museum's file says, "Mask previously dipped in Doble's solution, a disinfectant." Ration Book, 1943. Wars can create shortages of important things like gas, food, and services. During World War II, the U.S. government created ration books to help control supplies, make them available fairly, and prevent hoarding. They were usually distributed based on household size and need. This ration book was administered to the Glasscock family of Raleigh by the Office of Price Administration. It says on the cover, "United States of America, Office of Price Administration, War Ration Book 4. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading from the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.